We hold these Friday seminars on a semi-weekly basis, covering a range of topics broadly related to transportation safety and occasionally other transportation or safety topics. Funding for this program was provided by a grant from the California Office of Traffic Safety through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Today we have Dr. Paul Grunewald from the Prevention Research Center. His research interests focus upon studies of the social, economic, and physical availability of alcohol, alcohol use, and alcohol-related problems, evaluation methodologies appropriate to community-based prevention interventions, and geospatial analysis. Dr. Grunewald is the scientific director for PRC, a research division of the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation that focuses on the development of sound scientific basis for the prevention of alcohol and drug problems. He also directs the Spatial Systems Group, a coordinating center for the PIRE-wide work using geographic information systems, spatial statistical systems, and spatial dynamic models. He has been a principal or co-investigator for 24 funded research projects. For those viewing remotely, we have you on mute, but we'll be monitoring the chat window on the webinar client in case you have any questions, and we will do our best to share them with the speaker during the presentation. And with that, I'll hand it over to Dr. Grunewald.
Thank you very much. I will do my best to speak clearly and loudly and explain what it is that I'm presenting here today. I've provided a somewhat unusual title. It says, where do all those drinking drivers come from? It seems like an easy question to answer. They come from places where they drink. It turns out, from a both geospatial point of view and from a social ecological point of view, it's actually a little bit more mysterious than most folks think. Yes, there's a lot of drinking drivers who come from bars, but they also come from many other places. So what I'm interested in presenting to you today is some analyses that help us measure where folks come from, where they've been drinking before they are caught up in drinking and driving, and then talk about the application of this information in community prevention initiatives. Dr. Bob Saltz, who was to originally present this, is a specialist in community prevention, and the back end of this presentation is actually provided by him and his colleague, M.J. Pascal. So they get credit here on the title. What's the time for this, by the way? I need to know if I need to rush.
Oh, about 45 minutes or so.
Oh, oodles of time. Okay.
Yeah.
So stop me whenever you want, and I'll just explain some information. I'm sure it'll be helpful to everyone. So, some facts about drinking and drunken driving in California. These are facts measured in 2009, specifically in a community study that we fielded in 50 cities across the state of California. The cities are between 50,000 and 500,000 population. I'll come back to that in a bit. But these are the facts. Just imagine you live in a community with 100,000 people. In a typical community in California in 2009, that meant there were 53,100 persons who have drunk at least once in the past year. 18,213 of those drove after some drinking. They produced 2,352,000 driving after drinking events. That's a very important number. 11,700 occasions when driving after drinking too much, that is, they told us that they had too much to drink to drive safely. 4,200 arrests for driving while intoxicated, 1,800 had been drinking motor vehicle crashes, and additional, by the way, 1,300 driving while intoxicated crashes, and 1,300 single vehicle nighttime crashes. Single vehicle nighttime crashes are crashes that occur when people are driving in their car by themselves and they hit something, usually some immovable object, like the abutment to a bridge or some such. Usually, about 70% of the time after midnight, these folks have been drinking, some of them quite a bit, at the point at which they have the single vehicle crash, and that's why it's reported. So drinking and drunken driving continues to be a major source of injury and death across cities in California. Remember, this is just a 100,000 population city. So if you're wondering what the police are doing in your community on any given day, this is most of their work, and they will tell you that. Right, if we can determine where these drinkers use alcohol before they drink and drive, then we can design preventive interventions suitable for those drinking contexts, which is really what this story is all about. It gets a little complicated in the mid part, but it will get simpler as I move towards the end. All right, so what is the study I keep alluding to? Well, I'm going to present an analysis of drinking agents and drinking places in what's called the California 50 City Study. This is a study that's been funded for 10 years by the National Institutes of Health to look at 50 cities in the state of California. and the study, not just drinking and driving, but all kinds of harms related to the use of alcohol among the populations living in these areas. So the 50 cities are a random sample of cities in California between 50 and 500,000 persons, which I've said before. It's an ecological sample of cities, and that's critical. So all the cities are spatially distinct from one another, and as you look at this map, you'll see they're spread out quite a bit across the state. The goal of the ecological sampling is to get cities that are representative of all the different kinds of areas and populations living in the state, from rural areas in the far north to highly urbanized small cities around Los Angeles. There are about 9,000 adult population surveys conducted across these cities, about 5,000 drinkers, and we collected a lot of other information. But the point of this figure is really to show you that this is a fairly solid representative sample of people living in the state and a representative sample of cities in the state, limiting them, again, to no more than 500,000 persons. So now I'm going to just jump to results. What we've been studying over the past 5 to 7 years is how people go about making choices where they drink and how much they drink in those contexts and how much that amount of drinking is related to problems. The problem I'm going to talk about today is drinking and drunken driving. But the most important part of this from an ecological perspective is just trying to figure out where do people drink and what kind of people drink where. So, oh, I see. All right. The animation has been canceled out. So I have to back up a little bit. Be patient with me. All right. So what are we doing in this study? We went ahead and we looked at personal characteristics of drinkers. In these 50 cities, these personal characteristics included impulsivity, risky driving. That's evidence that people typically drive in risky ways. It's really rather surprising. This is a 10-item checklist, and you'd be amazed at the number of people who report that they tailgate and run red lights. It seems like almost commonplace for some folks. Tolerance of deviance is a standard social psychological measure of the willingness to tolerate variations in other persons' behaviors. And DUI networks is a critical measure of the extent to which people are in social networks with other drinking drivers. So one of the risks is if one of my friends is a drinking driver, I'm more likely to drive after drinking. That's pretty much what's captured in the DUI networks measure. We also look at drinking characteristics and their use of drinking places. That's what we call by venues.
And what's tolerance of deviance?
It's one of my least liked measures. It is a measure of the degree to which you tolerate other people's variations in their behaviors. So it's a
variations,
right. So it would be I am a typical drinker and I only drink one or two drinks, but you drink 10, right? I'd be a tolerant person if I accepted your behavior and did not censor it. All right. You'll be surprised at a couple things that pop up there. I don't like the measure in particular, but it's one that's very widely used. We relate those characteristics to drinking patterns, which is drinking characteristics in the middle, and the distribution of venue use, which is the ecological part I'm really trying to drive at here. So there's also in these models a lot of controls for demographics and city characteristics and so forth. I'm going to set all those aside for the rest of this talk and focus on these three things. So what happens? Well, impulsive people, if you look at the light blue line, usually show up in because I've lost the animation, I'm stalling for a moment while I capture my thoughts. If you're a low impulse control person or you're an impulsive person, you're more likely to drink frequently and you're more likely to drink at higher quantities. If you are a risky driver, you're more likely to drink more frequently and you're more likely also to drink at higher quantities. If you have greater tolerance of deviance, you are more likely to drink heavily. And if you're embedded in a DUI network, you're more likely to drink heavily and at higher quantities. These are kinds of standard alcohol epidemiology facts. They reflect a lot of the other surveys that have been done over the last 50 years in the United States. They're not all that interesting. What's more interesting is the right side of the figure. When you look at the right side, first of all, looking at drinking frequencies, the rule of thumb for all ecological analyses of alcohol use is that the more frequently you drink, the more frequently you drink everywhere. All right, that's a trivial observation, but an absolutely critical one. Infrequent drinkers drink primarily in their homes, their own homes. As you increase the frequency of drinking, your drinking spreads out to other people's homes, parties, restaurants, and bars. The big transition going from age 20 to age 21 is that a lot of commercial establishments become the places where you drink. Before that, you may drink just as much, but your drinking will be distributed in different locations. Heavy drinkers, looking at the red lines at the bottom, are especially fond of drinking in other people's homes and at bars. The reason for other people's homes is it's a low-cost social venue. It doesn't cost a lot to drink someplace else or in somebody else's house. Bars is a high-cost venue where the alcohol is marked up by about 100% per drink. So that's a general description of the underlying ecology we'll be talking about. Yeah.
We have a question online. Somebody asked, what is the difference between drinking large quantities and heavy drinking?
Okay, drinking, all right, I conflated them a little bit. Drinking quantity is just the average amount that people use. Heavy drinking is drinking beyond that point, much more heavy drinking. So that clarifies those two, the distinction between the two things. All right, so the next slide. What we're really interested in, among other things, is what personal characteristics line up with the use of these different venues. And this is where things get interesting. If you have poor impulse control, if you're impulsive, you're going to be more likely to be found drinking at parties and at bars. If you're a risky driver, you're more likely to be found drinking outside the home, particularly in restaurants and parties, and again at bars. If you have low tolerance of deviance, which surprises everyone, you're more likely to drink in bars. That means that people that are in bars have less tolerance of deviance. And if you are in a DUI network, you're more likely to drink, surprise, in bars. So bars are an interesting location. The folks who, on average, who participate in drinking in bars are different from the rest of us on average. They are more likely to be low impulse control, risky drivers, less tolerant of deviance, and be inside some sort of DUI network, meaning they know other people or their friends include other people who have driven after drinking. All right, so why are we looking at all these things? Now, if you go back and remember what I showed you in the second slide in the show, in this presentation, I was pointing out how many different drinking and driving events actually occur in this small city of 100,000 people. This is the same information presented in a different fashion and now presented over only a period of 6 months just because the math worked out more easily this way when I calculated it. I want you to pay attention to only the first two columns here. The first column are the same venues that you saw in the previous picture. The second column is the number of occasions in which people drink in these places over the course of 6 months. Yes?
How is the data collected?
These are self-reports from surveys. Yes. The question was, how are the data collected? Yes. There's 9,000 surveys of adults in the 50 cities with folks reporting where they have drunk over the previous 28 days, actually, and 6 months. Right? And that's used to construct this information on where people typically drink. The figures here are not exact, of course. They're only approximations. What's really interesting is to look at the order of magnitudes that separate one number from the other. So drinking at home, the number of events there for 100,000 population city is 1,259,798. At bars, it's about 97,000. At restaurants, 152,000. And at parties, about 99,000. 99,000 events. Now, going over to the next column, the columns labeled driving after drinking events. If we just take the average rate at which people who drink subsequently report driving after drinking, which is 7.6% of those events, what we see is there's about 68,000 driving after drinking events associated with people who drink at home, 5,000 at bars, 8,000 at restaurants, 5,000 at parties. So you see there's a flow of drinkers through these establishments, and just on average, there's more likely to be find somebody who has been drinking at their home out on the streets driving after drinking. Moving to the next column over, we do the same thing for driving after drinking too much. We see 1,411 for own home, 108 for bars, 169 for restaurants, 111 for parties. What this tells you is that a large proportion of people out on the roads who are driving when they've said they've had too much to drink are likely to be coming from their own homes, which is quite different from what you typically think about when you're thinking about preventing drinking and drunken driving. Now, the big question, of course, is this real? It's quite possible that these are the averages, and the averages seem to indicate that drinking at home is a risk of some sort, but in actual fact, when you go and we look at the risks that actually are experienced by people who are drinking at home, they report that they never subsequently drive after drinking. Right, so these figures might be distorted because we're just simply taking an average. So the rest of this analysis is trying to sort that out. So the first stage is, okay, well, let's look at the different venues, and let's see what the frequency of driving after drinking is associated with these venues, particularly using this more detailed information from these surveys. Well, what we see is that people who drink at restaurants are more likely, more frequently drive after drinking. People who drink at bars are more likely to be heavier drinkers at these establishments. They don't drink more frequently, they just drink more when they're in the place, and that's related to driving after drinking. Same thing with drinking at home. And more often you are at parties, more likely you are to drive after drinking 4 hours. 2 points to be made here. If you look across the bottom, all the personal characteristics have evaporated. There is no relationship between these personal characteristics and drinking and drunken driving. Much of the research literature emphasizes the psychological or the cognitive social characteristics of drinkers and their importance to predicting drinking and driving. If what the story here I'm telling you is true, those characteristics are mostly about your choices as to where to drink, your social networks in which you embed your drinking, and the way you arrive in a location when drinking with your friends. It's not about your choice to drive after drinking once you get in a location. So the ecology might be very dominant. The second point here is that everyone usually gets confused by what I'm talking about when I say heavier drinking related to driving after drinking. All that means is that on average, people arrive at the bar or are drinking in their own home. And when you drink more heavily, that heavy drinking measure, your risks related to driving after drinking increase. So think through that again. You imagine folks drinking at home, but the heavier drinkers at home are more likely to get in their cars and drive away. A common story among people who show up in first offender drunk driving programs is that they were drinking at home and watching a football game, and after they ran out of the second six-pack, they got in the car and they drove to the store. They didn't make it, okay? The police found them first. So it's not an unusual story. But what this little detail tells you is it's heavier drinking in those locations that matters. So moving on. What about driving after drinking too much? Now, even less information is here in a funny sort of sense. Remember that behind these pictures is the average rate at which people drive after drinking or report driving after drinking too much. On top of that average rate, the more often you drink at the restaurant, in a sense, the safer you are. So restaurants provide some safety, in a sense, for driving after drinking. I don't know exactly what that means, but we can come back to that. Drinking in your own home, though, once again, the more heavily you drink in your own home, the more likely it is you're going to report driving after drinking too much. And then again, none of the personal characteristics matter at this point.
So what's the red and the green again?
Heavier drinking at home. Yes, not just drinking at home,
okay. But
on top of drinking at home, heavier drinking at home.
That's the red?
It's the increased risk related to drinking that extra drink or two.
Okay.
All right. So you're sitting on your couch watching a football game. You typically drink a six-pack.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're at 2 6-packs. That's when you go out and try to get the third one. Okay. There's some sort of risks involved in that.
The restaurant is greater, is what you're saying?
No, the restaurant, that little negative sign is up there because it's the only negative relationship in the entire set.
Okay.
Right. So there's something about restaurants that sort of ameliorates the risks for driving after drinking too much. Okay, but there's really, to make a point of it right now, there's two stories about restaurants. Remember, there's an average rate of driving after drinking too much, and that's being pushed up because the driving after drinking events are all being pushed up by going to restaurants. What this says is that conditional upon that, driving after drinking is a little bit safer for driving after drinking too much. Who wants to go to sleep? Are you timing this or watching the time for me?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So did that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks. The questions are great.
Just click on the...
What do I need
the
to
middle.
Click on the screen.
Okay.
Got
it. All right. Thanks. All right. Once again, the animations are missing, so bear with me. I stumble a little bit. This is, again, the same picture that you saw before. You'll notice in the right two columns there are three numbers now instead of a single number presented. The numbers I presented in the original slide are the first numbers in the columns related to drinking in your own home, at bars and restaurants and parties. So what is this story about? Remember, I keep emphasizing that there's this overall exposure The more frequently you go to some place, you have an average risk for drinking and driving and an average risk for driving when you've had too much to drink. So the first number is from the previous table. If you remember, I said there were 68,243 driving after drinking events associated with drinking in one's own home. And I pointed in that, and I said that's a lot. All right. Well, the number might be reduced a great deal, right, if you consider the possibility that people drinking in their own home really don't have that average risk. Unfortunately, if you think back to the previous two slides, drinking at home always increases risks with regard to both the exposures to driving after drinking and too much. So there's not a lot of savings involved. In fact, there's really no savings involved. So that's what this story is about. So let's focus on the column, driving after drinking events intersected with own home. We have 68,243 total events, and using a statistical model, we calculate that there are 11,123 of these events specifically related to drinking in one's own home and the risks that accrue there. That means the heavier drinking that accrues there and all the other kinds of things. So we've left unexplained 57,120 events. Those events are explained by exposure. So in a traditional epidemiological approach to these data, you'd say, well, what's driving this system seems to be all exposures. It's how often you go there, and being there doesn't seem to ameliorate your risks at all. You carry into your context a probability of driving after drinking or a probability of driving after drinking too much, and that stays fixed. It is not ameliorated or changed by being in any different context. So if you look through the numbers, and that's where why they're labeled in red here, what you see is that they don't change a lot. The red numbers are essentially those crashes, those events related to the exposure, with everything else subtracted out. And that's true both for driving after drinking events and driving after drinking too much.
So again, by exposure, you mean the duration of time that you spend at the table?
The number of occasions you are there over a course of 6 months. So it's kind of like time, but it's really the number of times you're there.
Number of, how you're kind of defining an event. So for home, kind of arriving.
For, this is drinking event in the home. Okay, so that's the way it gets isolated, right? You have to be drinking in the home. These are really daily measures. So you get something like number of drinking days in the home. Or number of drinking days in a bar.
That drinking took place, that's an event.
Right.
That's kind of your...
It's a very crude measure, but it's the kind of measure you can get out of survey data. And when it comes to bars and restaurants and parties, since there's usually only one event per day, it's a fairly good measure. It's certainly a good measure of the intensity of using these places because the rates of using these places vary enormously in populations. So typically, if for drinkers that only drink a few drinks, that's how I can easily say, oh, they're mostly drinking at home. It's because as the number of drinks per month increase up to 28 drinking days, all the behaviors expand out into commercial establishments, and the rates get very high. So I'm comparing fairly large ranges of numbers here.
So then what are you considering high rates of drinking events per month? So it can go beyond 28.
You can have more than 28 events in places and have only 28 drinking days.
Right, so you can have more than 28.
And in fact, on average, there's 20% more.
Different places.
That's right, yeah. So on average, there's 20% more in the entire population. And that usually is accounted for by drinking at home. It's called preloading and then going out, right? Or postloading, in a sense. You come back home and you drink more, right? So there's combinations that make sense. When you look through the data, it's quite rational. A lot of drinking is always taking place at home. Remember, that's the infrequent drinkers are going to be drinking there anywhere, anyway. And as you add drinking frequencies, they tend to expand their behaviors out in different places. They also tend to drink in more than one place in a single day. All right. You'll be glad to know that bar hopping is only popular among college students, it seems. So in the rest of the population, that doesn't seem to happen at all.
That's very logical.
Yeah, well, I agree. Right. And there's not much restaurant hopping either. So, okay, so that's good clarification of what the numbers mean. Right. They're the best we can get from survey data. You really can't get much more detail other than that in survey data. So is this figure more or less clear? My emphasis here is the red numbers in which I show that the exposures are high across all these places and that these are really independent of the places themselves. It's a very interesting sort of observation.
Again, you have the for the restaurants and the driving after drinking too much, that's the negative you referred to earlier?
Correct. So the one negative number in the pile there is just whatever the ameliorating impacts are of drinking in restaurants.
What do you think is happening there?
I don't know what's happening there. What people talk about in restaurants that may be the case is that restaurants tend in communities. And remember, these are fairly stable communities. Forget about Berkeley. Don't think about college communities. Think about the rest of the world, all right, because that's what we're talking about here. The restaurants themselves know their customers reasonably well, and it's actually a protective effect for people that are drinking too much because they'll get a cab, they'll find another way home, and so forth. That's the general claim.
And for a bar, they probably know each other very well.
So and they drink more.
Yeah,
correct.
So why is there a minus study? Why is there a negative driving event?
It reduces the number of expected driving after drinking too much events by 46 events. It's very small, right? It's a testimony to the precision of the analysis more than it is anything else, and it might actually be an artifact. I mean, with all the numbers I'm presenting you, I'm sure there are some artifacts here, and these are small values. And what I'm emphasizing is the difference between that 169 and the 215 below it, or the accumulated sums across these rows in these columns where we're talking about tens of thousands of events that are not accounted for by where you go, meaning this is the risk you carry with you every time you go out and you drink. All right, so moving along. All right, so one of the things to pay attention to here is there's another issue that's always important within communities, and this is, gets us towards community prevention, which is think about the number of different places you can drink. If you're drinking in your own home, on average, in a city of 100,000 population in California, there are 18,683 drinking premises. These are about the number of households in a city of population 100,000 which contain drinkers. It's very simple. It's an approximate number, but it tells you around 20,000 households are where the drinkers are. Well, how many drinking and driving events are there then with regard to these premises? There's 3.6 per premise. And how many driving after drinking too much events are there? There's 0.08. Very, very small rates spread across a very, very large population. Look at bars, which is the point of this. There's only 15 on average. But people are telling us that roughly there's 357 of these drinking and driving events per bar every 6 months, and roughly 7 or 8 of these events per bar every 6 months, driving after drinking too much events per bar. Now, the numbers look a little odd. Now you have to go off and talk to the police department. And the police department will tell you, this sounds about right. We pick up a handful of people every so often, and they're coming from this guy's bar or that guy's bar. And, of course, there's always one bar in the city that produces more than the others, and there's always a sort of safer bar than any others, but it's not safer because there aren't drunks there. It's safer because they're wealthier, and they typically take taxis home. Right, so the police know this very well, and so these rates actually line up reasonably well with what the reports are from police departments. But the point, again, is the throughput of drunks. It's exactly what you'd expect. There's going to be more drinking drivers going through bars, more people reporting driving after drinking too much after they've been at a bar, and this is going to be vastly greater on a bar-to-bar basis than it is on a home-to-home basis. Again, the point here from a prevention point of view is that you have focal points which are producing many events, but you have actually more events produced from a very large ocean of people drinking and driving at home, after drinking at home. So, some conclusions.
Do you have some idea of the number of people that go to a bar in such an area of this size?
100,000 people? I mean,
yeah.
100,000 population?
Yeah, per day, for kind of how many people?
We could calculate it. I would be afraid to tell you because I've seen so many of these numbers at this point that I will likely quote it incorrectly. But yes, it's possible to give that information, get that information quite easily. My recollection is it's about 30% of the drinkers use a bar at some point in the previous month. Okay, now, that's a recollection. Okay.
Yeah. My question was more kind of to understand the kind of the occupancy or the number of people that actually go to bars, not as a single time, but kind of people go in and out.
Oh, we can't. Yeah. We can't tell. Yeah. We actually have fielded a study where we attempted to work with people who've gone to bars and interviewed them, and it turns out that most people who go to bars really don't have much interest in talking to you. So it's a fairly closed community, which is kind of surprising to us. We thought it would be more open. So conclusions from what I've been presenting are that drinking and drunk and driving events are differentially associated with drinking context. So yes, some contexts produce more drunken drivers than others. But importantly, they're broadly distributed with respect to households. Low numbers per household, but many, many, many households. And they're sharply focused with respect to bars. High numbers per bar, few bars. So drinking in the home appears to be associated with the greatest number of drinking and drunken driving events. So why are we preventing people from drinking and drunken driving by looking at bars? This says we're looking in the wrong place. So, is this for real? That's a good question. So let's look at two other pieces of information. Let's assume that this is just an analysis that might be wrong. It's based on survey data. It's going to be fairly crude anyway. So one of my specialties is geospatial models of alcohol-related crashes. We've looked at the crash, every crash reported in the state of California for the last 15 years, and there's tens of millions of them. We've looked at every alcohol-related crash. We've looked at every had-been-drinking crash. This is a crash in which the police report that the person has, shows evidence of having drunken some alcohol at the time. Having some alcohol on board is the way they refer to it. And every single vehicle nighttime crash in the entire state for all communities and for the 50 communities in this original study. So our question there was, well, what's the geographic distribution of these crashes? It's a difficult question to answer. But it came out with a peculiar signal, and that's on this slide. All right, we call this the donut hole slide. The donut hole is on the right, but I won't explain it yet. I want to talk about the hole first, which is to the left. If you look at the for all cities in the state, if you look at the distribution of bars and also restaurants, but here we're showing bars, you see, after a fairly large amount of spatial analysis, that the crashes actually accumulate around the bars. There's more crashes in those areas related to alcohol. Right, and those are disentangled in these analyses from all the other crash sources possible. Right, so the signal can be seen, and it can be seen related to bars. And if you look at, think of the previous slides, that's not too surprising. There's about 300 of these kinds of events, you know, opportunities to crash for each bar every 6 months. So you should see a signal. The more interesting thing for us is on the right-hand side. When we first saw this analysis, we wondered why in heaven's name, could we see all these crashes in the peripheral areas of these cities around these residences? And it seems to confirm or agree with what we just saw, which is there's a very large proportion of drinking and driving and drunken driving crashes that occur when people just get in their cars and drive away from home. So there's some evidence from population level analyses that supports this suggestion. It certainly provides an interesting view onto drinking and drunken driving. Yeah.
Can you explain the color coding system?
Yes. These are the results of fairly sophisticated Bayesian space-time models, but they're reduced to a simple statement. So each one is the relative risk, where the relative risk is set by all other sources of possible crashes for each of these locations in the state. These are census block groups. This includes a vector of about 20 different demographic measures, but more importantly, the underlying history of crash rates in every location for 15 years. So if there's a hot spot, it's corrected in the analysis. If there's a cold spot, a place where there are very few crashes historically for whatever the reason might be, right, it's also taken into account. So this is relative to all those corrections. And the numbers run from the light green on the right, about 0.1 to 0.6, to the dark green on the right, about an increase of 11% to 88%, right, in terms of the relative risk of a crash related to, in this case, it's had been drinking. All right. The have-been drinking reports, by the way, are extraordinarily good. There was a validity study done on these reports a few years back, and police actually do a good job of identifying people who have been drinking, have some alcohol on board. So when it's validated against blood alcohol tests and about a variety of other methods, the police come out, you know, looking pretty good. They can identify these. But also in this analysis, we recalibrate all this around single-vehicle nighttime crashes where we know there's 70% involvement of alcohol in each particular crash, and we see the same pattern. Yes?
You'll probably get to this, but do you know anything about the characteristics of people who tend to drink at home? Like, are they usually men? Are they older folks?
Yes, I do, but I'm not sure I have it in here.
Oh,
I'm happy. Can we talk about that separately?
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll come back to that. There are interesting patterns. So, all right, back to where I was. Right, so this is the general background. There's something even more important, though. Right, for some 15 years, the County of Ventura, California, has collected what they call place of last drink data. This is data that's acquired from people that are stopped by the police for drinking and drunken driving. It is not an arrest. It's an incident, so-called. And when they're stopped in the County of Ventura, the police have permission to ask where you had been drinking before. It's not allowed to be put into evidence. It's just collected. Right? That way they don't get encumbered by legal issues. And they report on this and use it for prevention activities in the county. So it's very unique. It's been also done in Montana, right, in the entire state, right, as an effort to determine what locations are most risky. It was done by me and a fellow named Tim Stockwell up in Canada, in, of all places, Perth, Western Australia. We were so successful at doing it that the legislature for Western Australia forbade us from ever collecting these data again. So this gives you an idea. It gets politically hot if it becomes an issue having to do with the legality of these reports. In Western Australia, those reports started to be used to sue premises. And the result of that was they shut down the entire system so they wouldn't have these lawsuits rising regularly through the judicial system. So set that aside. Ventura County seems to be going on quite happily with it, and they figured out how to do it. What do they find? So stopping people at roadside because they are weaving or give some indication of drinking and drunk and driving turns up 51.9% who report that they've been drinking in a private residence. That's at a party or in their own homes, right? 37% report having been drinking in a bar or club, 12% reported they've been drinking in a restaurant, and underage drinkers use private residences more often, which is not a surprise at all, okay? They shouldn't be using commercial establishments, at least you'd hope. So this is another source of data that lines up relatively well. A really big surprise to the folks in Ventura and in Montana and to us is that if you look at people who have been convicted of drinking and driving, you might think these numbers were somewhat different. They're actually not. Once again, they're very stable exposures, very stable ecological exposures.
Why would you expect them to be different?
The general view of repeat drinking and drunken driving drivers and those that get convicted is that they're an aberrant class, right? So these would be the low impulse control, members of DUI networks, high tolerance of deviance, and whatever the fourth one is that I sometimes forget, all right, characters. Those personality characteristics have been used to predict who drinks and drives for over 50 years, right? And they've been demonstrated to be adequate and inadequate in the same way. They're adequate in that they're stable correlates of drinking and driving and a lot of other risks. They're inadequate because they've only accounted for a very small percent of everything that's going on. And so there's a great deal of puzzlement among social psychologists in particular about why it is that that's the case. Right. I'm giving an argument here that one of the reasons that's the case is there's this broad noise, in a sense, due to ecological characteristics of the way people use places, so that these decisions, which do relate to these behaviors, are really isolated in one slice, which is the decision to walk out the door and go to a particular place and join your friends to drink. Once that's established, the ecology takes over.
Then you're expecting people to have a prior violation that their distribution would be different because they
would be aberrant.
Cautious,
yeah.
To put themselves in a situation that they're out of their home or something.
Right.
Like, you're expecting to have a higher proportion of drinking at home than people who have not had.
One of the possible ways.
You're
right.
Saying that it's not the case.
It just doesn't seem to vary that way. Yes. Again, remember we're talking about order of magnitude comparisons. All right. So
right.
These will move around by 10 to 15%. But still the majority will be coming, or the great plurality, from private residences, right? Next to that will be drinking in a bar or club, because it's just producing so many per unit.
The thing is not a different difference in the drinking in private residence is less than 10%?
Yeah, about that. Right. I mean, you're asking me to remember.
It might still be a big number.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, the problem with everything having to do with private residences is the number can be very substantial with very small differences. So once again, you get caught up on that problem. So moving along, this is a little validation step. Okay. Now, what do you do with this kind of information? This is the Bob Saltz and MJ Pascal presentation, right? It's worth looking at, because the big problem here is not just collecting these information and making observations about what it is that or what the characteristics are of people who engage in drinking and drunken driving, or the locations in which they drink and drunken drive, right? But what do you do when you get this information, right? The cities and counties in the United States interested in this kind of work have been supported by SAMHSA's Strategic Prevention Framework State Incentive Grant. It's called SPIFSIG. I wrote it out here because I inevitably forget what the acronym means, but they're quietly nicknamed the SPIFSIG grants. Every state in the United States has these grants, and these grants are to support a variety of interventions to reduce a number of problems, but included among those are drinking and drunken driving. SAMHSA's specific goal here in California is to develop prevention infrastructure to support evidence-based interventions to reduce excessive drinking among 12 to 25-year-olds, achieve that reduction at the community level. They emphasize community interventions, and demonstrate that achievement via formal evaluation. And Dr. Saltz and Dr. Pascal are running a formal evaluation of such a project in the state of California. Among the 50 cities that were examined over the last 10 years, we've selected 24, and they comprise an experimental and comparison group that will be examined over the course of the next few years to see whether these community-based preventive interventions work. The emphasis on 12 to 25-year-olds is a little bit of a distraction all the time to me, because these are not the people that are necessarily the drinking and drunken drivers. Drinking and drunken driving peaks among males between the ages of 30 and 50. Generally, that's believed to be practice. Another argument, which is more, I'm more fond of, is that's wealth. Right? These are folks that can afford to drink and drive. Right. They can afford to do it in two ways. One is they can afford the places where they do drink and drive, and they go to restaurants and bars more often, but also they can afford the risks. So when a license is taken away from a wealthy person, it has a very different impact on their lifestyle than a license taken away from somebody who's poor. The consequences are quite dire for low-income individuals. Right. But it's important to pay attention to the difference and to realize that the project, as emphasized by SAMHSA, is 12 to 25-year-olds. So they're doing an intervention study among 24 of the 50 cities. SAMHSA supports the intervention, and IAAA supports the formal evaluation. And their goal is to use what they call effective evidence-based practices, which move from research into stages of implementation, where the research helps you define how the implementation takes place, to prevention practice. And from an applied perspective, this is actually very interesting. This figure is not. The next one is. All right. Well, two-way. So they're going to use something called logic models. Now, these are commonly talked about at the federal government and state government level as ways of characterizing how a problem behavior emerges in a community so that you can understand how to intervene. One of Bob's specialties has been to lay these out in detailed ways so that communities can see where the problems arise and then act to intervene in as much a directed way as possible. So for them, they take a basic question, like, why is underage drinking more prevalent in some communities than others? They'll present this to a community audience. Say, why do you think? All right. So what does the research say? The research says this big, complicated thing you see here. Now, unfortunately, the animation's not on, so I'm not able to show you. But what we're showing is the underlying evidence that's accumulated over the past 7 or 8 decades about underage drinking shows that there are a few strong determinants or correlates of that behavior. One of them is beverage prices, right? The more expensive alcohol is, the harder it is for underage drinkers to get the alcohol, and the less likely they are to use it. Right? Another one is retail availability, meaning the easier it is for them to obtain such a good through a retail establishment like a convenience store, the more likely they are to drink underage. Another one, social availability, which you can also see here. Another one is how well enforced are underage drinking laws. To many of you, this should be very common, right? And we would hope so. More common knowledge. To communities, it's not always such common knowledge, that's the first thing, but more importantly are these little bubbles you see laid out here. Over the last 30 years, these bubbles represent various things the communities have tried to do to reduce drinking and drunken driving and underage drinking among young people. All right, one of them is decoy operations. This is having 21-year age and older individuals who look 18 years of age go into places as decoys and attempt to purchase alcohol. Having purchased alcohol, two things could happen. The police could sponsor the activity, right, which would then be entrapment, so they can't arrest the person or fine them, but they usually give them a little sticker that says, if we had the opportunity to do so, we would arrest you, right, for selling to an underage drinker. Right? That really has a huge effect. Most retail establishments want to actually be responsible, but they often don't know either whether they're being responsible or not, or the management practices are such that the person behind the cash register isn't paying attention, right? Those are decoy operations. Another one are social host liability laws and regulations, which are fairly new over the past 10 years, and I'll just use that as my other example. In that particular case, we have parties that take place, you know, sometimes in vacant houses sponsored by teenagers where they get together and, you know, collect a great deal of alcohol and a great deal of people and drink a great deal. All right? And these parties often, you know, end up in some dire consequences, not the least of which is drinking and drunk and driving crashes, as these young people drink to 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning and attempt to drive home. Social host liability laws hold these hosts, quote, responsible. That means the person who owns the vacant house at which a party takes place, even though they're not there, are responsible by law for making sure that these parties do not take place on their premises. Right, that's quite severe, and it's a matter of argument in the courts right now as to whether you can uphold that particular regulation. But it's inactive now in a number of counties throughout the state. Right, another form of social host liability, though, that's more common is for parents to permit alcohol used in their home among underage drinkers. This is permissible for your children. This is not permissible for you to do with someone else's child. So that particular regulation can be easily enforced by the police. The police just have to enforce it, and the police have to find out where the parties are. All right. So these social host liability interventions are enforcement interventions that help police become informed, but of course they don't work unless the public is informed. And I, for example, notice that my daughter comes home drunk from a party and my next-door neighbor is running the party, and I choose or not to report that that behavior is taking place. So those are that's another example. I could go through the rest of these, but that would take too long. This is just to let you know there are interventions available that will be that are effective. Okay. So how do you move communities from concepts to action? All right. Bob uses some very simple interactive software designed for group strategizing. So they work around the table to figure out what to do in their communities. Okay. The focus is on specific steps to achieve change. The main prevention target, for example, retail availability might be one of them. So here's a sample page from one of these models, right? You can find these models on www.doview.com. There's a variety of them. And they simply build these with the communities. Here's an example of retail availability, where you see retail availability of alcohol to youth is related to invisible enforcement, underage drinking laws, the social availability of alcohol to youth, and so on. Right? The green boxes are what the discussion's all about. What can you do? All right, you can use retail training and rewards. All right, what does that mean? That means you train the person behind the cash register not to sell to underage drinkers. It takes almost nothing to get folks to do it, right? But it does require that the management of every establishment engage with their employees to emphasize that they should be careful. That small difference makes a big difference in the long run, right? Compliance checks, citations, license loss, that means having the police reinforce those retail trainings. There's other things called party patrols, shoulder taps, keg registrations, things you might have heard. Shoulder taps are particularly useful. That would be a young person standing outside a convenience store who taps an adult on the shoulder and asks them to purchase alcohol for them. It works about 60% of the time, by the way. So it's very frequent, right? And it's very easy, right? The reason that's done by the police is it reminds folks not to do that. right? It doesn't take much more than a policeman handing you a card and saying, I've got you, to change behavior. If that doesn't happen, though, behavior change doesn't happen at all, right? So the engagement of the police here matters a great deal, right? And then there's media advocacy and other things. So this is the way that you engage communities around these issues and focus on specific strategies they can follow. The key elements of the approach are to clarify the partnership of science and practice, okay? And Bob really emphasizes this a lot, which is that research is used prescriptively, right? It prescribes what to do, right? But it doesn't tell you a thing in terms of how to do it. And that's why local expertise has to be used instrumentally. You have to get people engaged in actually executing these activities. It's highly focused on objectives rather than process, meaning it's not about coming to an agreement about what's important. The science should tell you what's important. Right? It's about coming to agreement on how to instrumentally enact some process that reduces the problem, right? And moves quickly through assessment and planning and focuses on measurable community-level outcomes. All right, so back to adult drinking and drunk driving. So what are we talking about here? Context-specific prevention interventions are needed. The science is telling us where the problems are, and responsible beverage service programs can work in bars and other on-premise drinking places. But interventions that affect use in the home are more problematic. How to do it is the critical unanswered question. So how do you keep the fellow who's on his third six-pack of beer from getting off the couch and going to the convenience store and buying the fourth one? That's the question. Youth access in the home is also a critical problem. The same people who are sitting on their couches having the third six-pack of beer, entertaining the idea of going to the fourth, has a young child in the house who's also got access to that alcohol. And that is where most underage youth obtain their alcohol. And social hosting laws address parties, but parties are not the core of the problem. Parties are there. Parties are a problem. Parties are that unique source, like a bar, which produces a lot of problems for a single source, right? But it's not the global problem. The global problem is drinking in the home or related to drinking in the home, okay? So how will we know that it worked? And this is an outline of that community-based preventive intervention. You can see it has two streams, a treatment and a comparison stream of communities. Over time, they're actually in the process of doing the intervention. One of them is in Ventura, which is kind of fun. And over the next 5 to 10 years, we'll actually have an answer as to whether these community-based preventive interventions worked. Prior experience is that these are very effective interventions. Environmentally based and ecologically based interventions are much more effective than educational interventions or other social norming interventions that have been using in these environments. I think, and so do my colleagues agree, that the reason for that is that much of this is ecologically based. That, once again, once you're in the place, your decision process is almost irrelevant. The behavior is going to be executed no matter what. So that's the end of my talk, I think. Thank you. Okay. Okay.
There was a campaign or some sort of effort on the part of Uber to where they were documenting their impact, some sort of an indirect evaluation of how Uber or these ride services are as beneficial for in terms of reducing drunk and driving.
Yeah.
Have you come across any of that in the surveys or was that, in the research and the literature in general?
Well, in the literature, there is a tradition of studying safe rides programs. They're sort of generally characterized that way. Mm-hmm. And safe ride programs work well when there are safe rides, right? And that's a silly thing to say, it sounds like, right? But what actually happens in reality is out there in the real world, when you don't have a group of interventionists providing opportunities for safe rides and encouraging all the time, is they go away. So they don't stick. Their lifetime is relatively short. You have to, quote, renew them all the time. So, I would guess, the claims are nice, and it is good to have safe rides, but the people who actually can arrange them are these establishments. That's why there's this, the belief that there's a restaurant effect, is that people become familiar with you as a drinker in a restaurant. Then the owner of the restaurant probably wants you to come back and will engage in trying to keep you safe. That's a really nice pro-social thing if the restaurant is doing it. And that's why community-based prevention and these steps from the science to the activity are so critical. It's a small activity that a restaurant owner has to do, right? But it's critical to get that in their heads. Once it's in their heads, they tend to do it fairly regularly. So the Safe Ride programs have not been very successful, largely because they're hard to hold into place, right? People will do it, right? But it's hard to maintain. Another one is the designated driver programs. They, again, will tend to work for a short period of time, but then fade. Right. So it's very hard to maintain that. The other thing for designated driver programs in particular is the person that's the designated driver is under huge social pressures to drink. So it takes a remarkably resilient character, right, to go to a place and not drink if they're a drinker at all. If they're abstainer, you're safe. Okay. If you're a group of males and the woman, and there is a woman that's a designated driver, you're more likely to be safe. If you're going in a group of women and the male is the designated driver, you're less likely to be safe. So the group dynamics seem to just take over.
In the case of the latter,
the man drinks.
No. But does the man drink irrespective of what the group composition is, or?
Male drinking drops on average relative to female drinking, but for any drinking, males increase more. So males have a big issue with alcohol. Seriously. Okay. So they're just are more reactive, more sensitive to pressure. They'll tend to drink more or more likely to drink when pressed to do so than a woman. So it cuts in both ways. Is that helpful?
Okay, so that's just about the end of our time, too, as well. So
okay.
Thank you for coming and sharing that
thank
with us today.
Thank you. I hope it was of some value. All right. Think ecological.
Thank you.
I liked your question. Thank you very much. And yours.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. So did you say that